Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. With less than a week to go in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, candidates make their final push. Plus, Universities of Wisconsin President Jay Rothman says he's been asked to resign, but won't. And a lawsuit to redraw Wisconsin's congressional districts is dismissed. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 3rd.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Lots going on this week. Let's start with what happened last night, which was the debate between Judge Maria Lazar, Judge Chris Taylor, kind of the last big push before Election Day on Tuesday. What were some of your takeaways from the debate?
There was no viral moment. Look, debates anymore. I wish everybody watched them, but they don't. That's the reality of politics and people's attention spans. So you're looking for a viral moment, something you put into a TV ad or push it on social media. There really wasn't one from I kind of what I heard from people. Were they good exchanges? Sure. Abortion came up, recusals, jousting back and forth, or being overturned. So it's good exchanges, but there wasn't a defining moment that I picked up or people I talked to that you would push out and try and change the trajectory of the race. Two, we have less than 5 days until people are done voting. They're voting as we speak. Thousands have already voted by the time this thing on the air. There's not really a window if this would change the race. If you had that kind of a moment, you've gotten it out, probably not. So it seems like things are kind of on the same path as they were before the debate took place.
Yeah, so let's take a look at some video from the debate, and then we'll talk a little bit about what makes this race so different from where we were about a year ago.
I hope that the viewers saw a huge difference between myself and my opponent. I have worked my entire 30-year legal career to protect the rights and freedoms of Wisconsinites and to make sure that everybody gets equal justice under the law. I have worked to move our state forward. My opponent has spent her legal career taking away our rights and prioritizing corporate interests and right-wing special interests. But this election is not about me and it's not about her, it's about you. I've traveled around the state of Wisconsin for the last 11 months. You have told me that you want a justice that's gonna prioritize you and stand up for your rights rather than the most powerful. That is what I will do as your Supreme Court Justice. I will be a justice for the people of Wisconsin. Thank you so much.
And I will tell you that this debate has made it very clear that the choice and what happens in this election could not be more important for our state and the future of our courts. In this race, you have on one side, we cannot risk putting 10 years on allowing a judicial activist to be on this court who will not use and follow the law, but will act and follow her causes, her agenda, and put those above everything else. That is what a legislator does. I have spent my entire judicial and legal career, 12 years on the bench, protecting the rights of people of the state. When the powerless challenge the powerful in my court, I listen to them and I decide the case solely based on the law and the facts. That is what a judge does. I will be your independent justice. I will, for the next 10 years, stand up for the Constitution, Wisconsin, and the rights. So I'm asking you to vote for me, Judge Maria Lazar, on April 7th. Thank you so very much.
Right. So again, a year ago, we were in the middle of the largest, most expensive judge race in American history, $115 million. This time around, everything is a little bit quieter, even the debate, as you just mentioned. And so looking at some of the numbers, fundraising spending numbers and then early voting numbers, the Taylor campaign has raised about $2.1 million compared to Lazar's $474,000 in the February-March reporting period. Overall spending, Taylor and her backers, $8 million. Lazar and her supporters, not even a million, $900,000. 115,000. And then comparing the number of early ballots cast as of yesterday, Thursday, 5 days out or whatever that is, 250,000-ish ballots cast compared to 5 days out last year, 475,000 ballots cast. So kind of no matter how you crack it, this is a slower, lower turnout, lower expense kind of race.
So, and I want to talk about the spending for a second. So I took what the Kantar reported spending through March 23rd. I took Ad Impact, which is a tracking service of ad buys. And then I took these independent expenditure reports that are submitted to the Ethics Commission. And I put them all on a spreadsheet. I love my spreadsheets. And in looking at that, yes, there's a huge spending advantage for Taylor. But what really stuck out to me was that there is not a single group doing a single expenditure to turn out voters for Lazar. Now, there are a couple of digital ad buys. There's a radio buy. Nobody's calling people on the phone. Nobody's going to doors. Nobody's sending literature. The state party, you know, it's doing some stuff. Turning Point Action, you see on social media that they say they're chasing votes in the spring primary or spring election, which is odd because even though they're an issue advocacy group, when you express advocacy in Wisconsin, you have to report it. They don't report it. I think it's illegal, but not quite sure, my lawyer. But like Americans for Prosperity, like they often do stuff in the spring elections. They are an issue advocacy group, but when they do doors, they report it. I'm not seeing AFP doing stuff. I'm not seeing Scotts Manufactured Commerce do stuff on the air. I'm not seeing the anti-abortion groups doing, you know, calling people. Why? That's the question. They came up in the debate last night. Lazar was asked, are groups not spending for you because you say you're not a conservative or because they don't think you can win? It's a conundrum for them. For her. So on the one hand, yeah, not a great record lately. 4 of 5 races lost by double digits. 2, Lazar is not really embracing the conservative mantle. So, you know, I'm an independent. I don't talk about issues, which I totally get. But with the Marquette poll, voters want to know what your issue, where you are on the issues. She's not doing that. So it's kind of like looking to Tuesday, look, there's still a path. Like if you see a surge of enthusiasm for Lazar, it could help. Democrats, you talk to them about the polling, they will tell you that there are a lot of undecideds. What they're not quite sure about is what Trump's going to look like on Tuesday. And two, they feel like Taylor is up and Democrats know that she's kind of their candidate. The undecideds, it seems like they go, I'm not sure, but they're not sure because they don't really aren't sure between the two candidates, or because they go, I'm a Republican, I know I don't like her, but I'm not sure I want to vote for her. Those voters, they don't turn out. There's no path for Lazar. So what I'm kind of watching is, one, will be any late surge of anything? It's kind of late at this point. And then two, what's turnout going to be on Tuesday? Go back, 2025 was like 2.3 million and change turned out to vote. 2023, about a little less than 2 million. 2020 was a presidential primary, so I kind of throw that one out the window. 2019, 1.2 million. 2018, less than a million. So are we even more like 18, 19? So if we are, probably good for Taylor, but there's that unknown of like what happens if all of a sudden somebody goes, I'm a conservative, I don't like her, I'm going to turn out for her anyway. Maybe.
Yeah, and you don't have that sort of, you know, the energy that the Democrats have had in the last couple of races of this is pivotal, this decides the ideological majority on the court. This time around, liberals are sort of in the clear. They have the majority no matter what. And so you're seeing that also in, I pulled, you know, numbers from the pass-throughs from the political parties. Democrats who threw a huge amount of money, again, behind Crawford last year. This time around, they transferred $700,000 to Taylor's campaign. The GOP transferred $60,000 to Lazar. So we're seeing much less involvement there. Presumably because, again, the stakes of this race aren't quite as high and the stakes of November's elections are higher. So there's a lot of probably math going on in terms of where do we want to be throwing our energy right now.
Excellent point. But for conservatives, if you lose this one, the hole gets deeper. And then next year, you don't win that one, the hole is even deeper. Like you're talking about creating a decade plus just to get out of this hole. If you lose this year and next year, how do you get out of that hole? The same time, the conservative coalition is going, we don't have a great electorate in spring. What do we do? And oh, by the way, if they were spending, remember Elon Musk when he spent last year? He was like extra rocket fuel of the Democratic machine. So they're almost like in a no-win situation. Yeah, they're not spending for Lazar, but they did. It reminded liberals, oh, I really don't like Donald Trump and Elon Musk and all those guys. I'm going to go So it's tough.
Yeah, in some ways, this is a little bit less of a reflection of national politics than the last couple ones have been. Even driving around, you know, liberal Madison, I'm seeing way fewer mm-hmm. Taylor signs. And she lives in Madison, you know, than, again, a year ago, all the Crawford signs that we saw around the city. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens on Tuesday. Again, early voting is underway, and so I think we'll also be following a lot of those numbers over the weekend. Also going on this week, the governor is taking action on dozens and dozens of bills. Earlier in the week, he vetoed a slate of bills around transgender issues, as well as one about school funding. This was very signaled in advance. He has said multiple times he will veto anything that he sees as harming the LGBTQ community. He has banned versions of some of these bills in the past. He had a sort of private veto ceremony about this. So he's really made it a pretty central issue of his governorship, which is interesting because we also are seeing some Democrats across the country really start to moderate their stance on this issue. Republicans seem to see it as winning for them, and so really kind of pushing it, again, in advance of November. So it's interesting to see Evers sort of standing very tall on this. And then talk a little bit about the federal scholarship tax credit program. This is an interesting, again, sort of Trump school choice priority that really reflected, I think, some of the school funding battles that we see here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and so you have to opt in as a state to this tax credit that people who donate to these causes. Now, the money can help public schools as well, but big push for choice programs. Democratic governors in other states have opted in. I think we're the only or one of only two states have not opted in. So interesting, but Evers is a public school teacher, public education advocate. For him, he sees this as an encroachment on public schools and a little too beneficial toward choice programs.
And so then we are keeping an eye on, again, a number of vetoes that may come out even as we are talking. We don't really know. A couple of lists were submitted, and so we have a sense of what is yet to come this week. The big ones being sports betting, name, image, likeness, and no tax on tips or overtime. We've obviously been talking about these for weeks and weeks, but there is kind of a big open question around sports betting. Some of the tribes are divided on whether they support it or not, so that's a big question. Name, image, likeness, it brings up all kinds of sort of UW funding. Funding back and forth, and then no tax on tips or overtime. Governor Evers proposed a version of that in his budget. Then it became a Republican priority. It's obviously something Trump ran on. And so there's these big questions about the political calculus of all three of these.
Yeah, so there are three ways for a bill to go to the governor. One, the governor can call for it. Two, lawmakers can send it to the governor. And three, there are automatic triggers built into every calendar in the session. So Thursday was the automatic trigger for like the spring bills. So the governor called for legislation, which is why he vetoed the trans bills on National Trans Visibility Day. A little symbolism there, right? He timed that. But now it's crunch time. Now we have 6 days, not counting Sunday, a week to you and I, for him to act on these things. He can sign them, veto them, or let them go to law without doing anything. He's probably going to take action on all of them. The betting bill, I mean, you kind of feel like he's going to sign it, right? Because it was bipartisan. He's a big UW advocate, loves volleyball, by the way. So, okay. The betting bill, online betting bill, remember, it doesn't legalize online gaming. It opens the door to it by defining an online bet as part of the definition of a bet in state law. That means Evers could do the compacts with the tribes and allow it. 8 of the 11 signed a letter to the governor urging signing of it. If you kind of look at that, you go, okay, the big tribes mostly were for it. Would the governor have allowed Democrats to provide the votes in the Senate to pass that bill? Because remember, it was like 17-16 and only 10 Republicans voted for it. Would he have done that like without being like, yeah, I'm going to sign it? You know, why? So, okay, you kind of think, you read the tea leaves on that one. The no tax on tips and overtime kind of became a partisan issue a little bit in the legislature. So I'm watching that one a touch to see what's going on. I think one of them has a price tag of like $470 million over the next year and a half. So that might be a way he goes, okay, pause on this one, let's hold off.
And then we got a little bit of news sort of right before we started taping, speaking of Governor Evers, which is there's been this big question about whether he was going to commute any prison sentences in his final year in office. It's been more than two decades since the last commutation in Wisconsin, and we just got an announcement that he's sort of setting up a structure in order to do commutations.
Yeah, so commutation different from a pardon. So he's done the pardon advisory board and all that. First one to do pardons going back to, because Walker did none. Commutation is not just like, I'm cleaning your record off. It's, I'm letting you out of jail, essentially, or prison. Now, there are going to be benchmarks. Basically, no sex offenses, child abuse, that kind of thing. You have to serve a certain number of years of your sentence, et cetera, et cetera. There'll be an advisory board set up to do this, but this is going to be Ivar's swan song, right? One of his like defining moments where he lets people out of prison. Don't forget, when he ran in 2018, there's this big push against the governor because he kind of hinted, I want to cut the prison population in half. Now, Republicans will tell you, you can't do that without like letting out violent people. So what's going on here? I don't know how expansive it's going to be. Again, we've only got, it's early April. He's going to be out of the office in early January. But something to watch to see, does this really make a dent in the prison population? Because it is going up, despite his promise to try to cut into it. And now he said in his release, this is because lawmakers are not taking seriously the whole criminal justice reform. If they're not going to do this, I'm forced basically to do this to try and address this issue.
Yeah, that'll be really interesting to watch. It's something that criminal justice advocates have been calling for, and of course it is something that often Republicans kind of run against, as this idea of being sort of soft on crime. So it'll be interesting that, you know, again, this is part of how he wants to see his legacies, including that. Also this week, a congressional redistricting lawsuit was dismissed. So this is that kind of complicated system where Republicans in 2011 put in place this requirement that if you want to redraw maps, the case has to go before a three-judge panel. This lawsuit, which was filed by a progressive group in D.C., did go before that panel, who then said, we do not have the authority to actually rule on this because those maps were enacted by the Supreme Court. So this is never tested before kind of system that doesn't really appear to have worked. And so now it's sort of an open question. I assume that this is going to get appealed, but it is putting to the test, like, who is in charge of these maps, given that a lower court cannot supersede the Supreme Court?
And what the lower court said, too, was nobody gave us any direction how to do this. So that 2011 law, isn't it clearly laid out, like, do you have a trial? What do you do? The Supreme Court in the order didn't say, hey, you guys are a fact-finding body. Like, are you an arm of the Supreme Court? Do you actually overrule the maps? It was like, hey, law says you guys got to do it. You got to do it. Now, there's a second case that's still pending, different three-judge panel. That one is the competitive gerrymandering case, right? So the map is drawn to protect incumbents. This one is the partisan gerrymandering case. And the court also, this one, said, hey, look, the Supreme Court previously of Wisconsin said there is no justifiable action, judiciable action. Basically, you can't go in court and sue over partisan gerrymandering in Wisconsin. That still exists. Yes, the Supreme Court returned the maps in the legislature in 2023. But in doing that, they found the map was unconstitutional because of it basically had municipal islands, pieces of like one community was in this district when the rest was over in this district, right? So it wasn't about partisanship. It was about this thing. So that standard still exists where you can't sue for partisan gerrymandering. If the Supreme Court overturned that, how do we, these three circuit court judges, overturn the Supreme Court? So lots of like complex layers, of course, like always. Now the question is, the second panel, also the motion dismissed pending before it, will conclude the same thing. It won't talk about partisan gerrymandering because it's talking about anti-competitive gerrymandering. But either way, there's no new map going to be in place by this fall.
Right, their arguments won't even be heard until after November. So for the midterm, sort of the big takeaway is no new maps. We will be voting according to the same maps in November.
You can start circulating nomination papers April 15th in Wisconsin. So a little late for new map at this point, Wisconsin.
Yeah. But certainly not too late for more and more lawsuits over redistricting, as I feel like we're always talking about those. Yesterday, we also got a pretty crazy story out of the Associated Press. They broke this story that there was, they got letters from UW President Jay Rothman to the board and the board president of the Regents saying, you've asked me to resign, I will not resign, which is sort of the first that anyone heard that he had been asked to resign. So there's a lot that we don't know about what is going on here, but what do we know?
So Rothman basically said, you've told me if I don't resign, you're going to fire me. I don't see a reason why. You haven't really given me good reasons, so I'm not stepping down. I would expect action in the coming days that will tee up them removing him because he's not stepping down. The question is why. Remember, Rothman was brought in to speak Republican, if you will, with the legislature, right? So the Board of Regents hired this guy who ran a law firm. He was an academic. He's kind of a Republican. He's donated to Republicans before. There's nothing wrong with that, obviously, but he was brought in because he could communicate to lawmakers, Republican lawmakers who run both houses of legislature. He wasn't successful in that. He has not gotten a bunch of money for UW. He has not made the case for UW to like shield them from these things. yes, the UW got more money in this last budget. It's because Governor Evers made a bottom line for himself saying, I want this as the final deal with me and Robin Voss and Devin LeMahieu. That's why they got it. So he's not been able to be successful doing that. And then two, there's this kind of sentiment of all the regents are all Evers appointees now, right? Except for the ones who are, you know, like the state superintendent and that kind of stuff who get on automatically. They're all Democrats going, at least some of them, why aren't you fighting harder for UW? Why don't you stand up to Robin Voss? Why don't you, like, if they're not going to give us, go fight back, right? There's that sentiment out there. And there's some other, you know, personal management stuff and that kind of thing. But so my question becomes a couple of things. One, who are you going to find to replace him? Like, what's going to be the charge going forward? And two, who are the players? So don't forget, so Robin Voss is going to be gone after the session. He's retiring. Devin LeMahieu, retiring. We don't know for sure who's going to control the legislature after the November elections. Are the regents saying, we're so confident that we're going to have, like, a Democrat in charge of, like, one house or the other that we should go, you know, a little more, like, our ideological bent? Are they confident about the governor's race? I don't know. Oh, by the way, I haven't checked this lately, but if you're not a confirmed regent, the next governor can come in and wipe you out your appointment right away. So, you know, there's all kinds of questions about what this board's going to look like. Who's going to pick this president? Like, will that board be around after January to be behind this president? It's going to be interesting to watch how this plays out. Again, assuming that that threat is not idle and they're going to remove him if he won't step down by sometime next week.
Well, and you have to kind of assume that Evers' appointed regents would have that timing in mind, right? Knowing that they might not have a Democratic governor after November, knowing that they, you know, who knows who will be controlling the legislature. And so does that mean that they kind of have a plan in place? Because this suddenly feels very, very rushed. It sounds like the meeting, the first meeting where he was asked to resign happened just a couple of days ago. So this is a very kind of sped up process that hopefully will be resolved in a couple of days just so that people kind of know what is going on, because it has been, I think it was a pretty shocking, a pretty explosive report from the AP. Also this week, there was the Special Committee on Oversight of the Department of Justice. They kind of released their report. So this was looking into the fact that the DOJ and Attorney General Call had partnered with NYU Law School fellows to do some litigating around environmental issues. This report found that Call broke the law in so doing. Call says he cleared this with the Ethics Commission. They didn't actually recommend any action. But this has really been a bit of a partisan battle. So let's take a look at some video from this committee meeting.
There is not one bit of evidence that I heard that suggested that Attorney General Josh Call was doing anything other than using every lever at his disposal to protect Wisconsin's land, air, and water from special interests. So that is what I am hearing from my constituents and folks across Wisconsin, is they want their communities and their families to be safe, and that is what they are expecting us as legislators to ensure and the Attorney General's office to deliver.
We don't want our justice system for sale, for hire by third-party activist groups, because it will come to a point where the DOJ will have a limited amount of employees directly from the state and by the legislature, but then possibly double that amount of activist groups being declared as volunteers or fellows or what have you. And that road, I hope we don't go down, and that legislation that comes out of this committee will prohibit it.
Okay, so they find that Josh Call broke the law, but they do not recommend any penalties. So sort of what is the point of all of this?
It's a great question. It tees up possible action legislature to kind of express real disapproval or to take additional steps. If you're a cynic, anybody in the room, you might think it was politics involved. But there is some real anger at Call from Republicans about a couple things. Like Doug Denny's a Wausau mayor. The whole thing with the Dropbox that he moved about a year ago now already. And that whole prosecution, there's some people up north who are unhappy about that. People are unhappy about this arrangement and the outside attorneys. And I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if it's appropriate or not. But they feel like this is not what we want to have be happening, where you can have outside influences being part of prosecutions in Wisconsin. So there's some real concerns here. But where's the beef in, like, the penalty or the next step? That's the challenge for these Republicans on this committee, is like, to, okay, what's next and really makes a breakthrough with the public? There is an election this fall. It might come up. Just going to guess. But I'm not seeing right now, like, a big push kind of behind it, kind of keep this ball rolling between now and November.
And then finally, your favorite topic, JR, we are talking about energy rate hikes. So a couple of requests came out of We Energies and the Wisconsin Public Service, basically both asking to raise rates in the amount of an average of $20 monthly by 2028 for We Energies and $16 monthly by 2028 for WPS customers. So what does that tell you?
So look, the utilities in Wisconsin, the major ones, they kind of like go every other year. So it's 2 years each time. So last year at MG&E, for example, now we're getting these two. I had somebody tell me a couple months ago that utilities are now the equivalent of eggs for like consumers. Like eggs were expensive last year, right? That was a big thing. Now it's about utility rates. Your bill is going up all the time. And so I did a story in November looking at the PSC under like all Evers appointees versus Walker ones to see how much they were approving in rate hikes. And it was substantial, like 2 point some billion in that 6 year window for the Evers appointees versus 300 million or 600 million. It's been a while. But a fraction of that. Now, there are things went into that. Inflation, much higher during the window with the Evers appointees. And utility rates are built upon, in part, construction projects. You add in more projects, like the price tag goes higher, and they're paid off over 30 and 50 years. So it's not like this one rate hike is going to take care of like X utility lines or X generation. They get added up. So the things that have been happening in Wisconsin are adding up, and you're getting these big rate hikes. The PSC has kind of got all of a sudden, ooh, no. We see the numbers. They're not good for Democrats because they've been in charge. So the question is, for all these campaigns for governor, what do you do about it? We've seen Mandel Barnes say, I'm not going to appoint any of the PSC or approve a rate hike. We've seen Tom Tiffany say, I'm going to ban prime farmland for solar panels. I'm going to reduce rates, and we're going to do more nuclear. Here's the catch. State law says when you do a rate case like this, you must give the utility an increase to cover their costs and allow them the opportunity to turn a profit. Unless you change state law, you can't reduce rates one penny. All right, that's what people tell me. So now if you change the law, different story. But how do you have them like build more stuff and say, no, you eat the cost? Now, is the profit margin appropriate? Again, not my place to say, but that's the, when you, everybody at home watches like this debate this fall about, we're gonna cut rates. How are you going to cut rates? Okay, Tom Tiffany, you want to do less solar, less windmills? Great. But they're already built. They're in the pipeline. That's not coming off. How do you reduce the rates? Mandela Barnes, great. Not going to point anybody who's going to prove a rate hike. How does that work with state law? So keep that in mind as the debate moves forward going on next 6 months or so.
Yeah, right. So lots of messaging again heading into November. No stock reports from us this week, so that will do it on Rewind. I am Uneven Wagton Donk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And we will see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association. Bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.